Hello, Paul Auerter with Medscape Infectious Diseases, and speaking from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Division of Infectious Diseases. There's perhaps no infection that's more disheartening than infected orthopedic hardware. Patients often must proceed through multiple surgeries and prolonged antibiotic therapies for weeks or months. Clinicians, surgeons, and ID consultants included have developed customary practices, but often feel uneasy with little robust clinical data to help guide with their choices. So I thought it was worthwhile and quite welcome to discuss the IDSA guideline that's just been published for prosthetic joint infections. I think it's a welcome addition to this area of clinical care, and it's been authored by an international panel of experts who have long labored in the field of musculoskeletal infections. I'd like to touch on some areas that I found interesting and or perhaps controversial within the guideline. Now, first, I'd have to say diagnosis is often a conundrum. Acute infection is rarely a difficult matter, but chronic infection can be something that is only manifest by pain in the joint or perhaps concern for loosening or mechanical failure, and infection only comes to light after joint replacement has occurred and swabs or cultures turn up positive after a new joint has been placed. These sorts of chronic or more indolent infections can be quite frustrating. And there's really, interestingly, no consensus on definition of these cases in the guidelines. And I think that's for several reasons. First, there's really no consensus, perhaps, because even the literature is replete with a variety of descriptions of how to define this. Although many people do feel that multiple cultures, three and upwards of five to six, taking at time of surgery, could help provide definitive information or perhaps an aspirate of the joint growing virulent organism such as Staph aureus. But for example, in the perplexing cases where you might call in a skilled histopathologist to perform frozen sections in the operating theater, there's a difference of opinion as to how to define this. One recent paper by Sarsis, for example, says that some have used 5 or 10 high-powered white blood cells per high-powered field. But even with this, it's reasonably helpful to rule in infection with an odds ratio of north of 54, which is quite good, but less helpful for ruling out infection with a negative odds ratio of only 0.23. So I do think the guideline was perhaps wise to sidestep this area, and indeed sometimes diagnosis is just in the eyes of the beholder. There are numerous situations where a joint's been removed. You may only have one or two cultures growing out coagulase negative staphylococci, but the patient's had rheumatoid arthritis and now has a new joint in place, and what do you do? So for that area, I think diagnosis remains controversial with really a need for new or better diagnostic methods to help confirm infection. There's a fair amount of language spent describing one and two stage exchanges, as well as revision arthroplasty or arthrodesis and amputation. Many of these I think we are very familiar with, and indeed in North America the tendency is towards two-stage exchanges in appropriate patients, whereas in Europe the one-stage exchange is performed perhaps more frequently for total hip arthroplasty. The choices of antibiotics again are not based on any kind of robust data, but typically are given for 4 to 6 weeks. One of the more controversial areas in the guideline has to do with the employment of long-term suppression strategies. And here there's really guidance, but a range such that really most choices could be accommodated in this guideline. For example, the panel split on chronic suppression for both retention of a prosthesis following IND, as well as in one-stage exchanges, with some giving limited antibiotics, some using long-term suppression, and in select situations, even using combination therapy with rifampin for staphylococcal infections. Much of this is not based on large amounts of data, and this part of the guideline might be better called a consensus statement or a lack of consensus statement rather than a guideline. Lastly, one of the areas that are often discussed, at least in the ID community, are prophylaxis guidelines, not really for perioperative prophylaxis, but more for dental prophylaxis, which orthopedic and dental literature guidelines have existed or statements have been made, yet ID clinicians are often hesitant to back up these recommendations based on scant data. This is sidestepping the guideline, probably because this is such a diverse area with so many different approaches, so many different organisms, such that trying to write this to cover all particular surgical strategies and organisms is extremely difficult. I think the authors did a nice job of trying to pull in as much information as possible, highlight where some of the controversies are or where differences of opinion really lead someone reading this to pick their own practice style. So clearly there is a need for more information. I doubt, though, that we'll ever get large amounts of robust data, at least with current strategies that are recommended by funding agencies or even for patients willing to undergo an RCT of one stage versus two stage. I think would be a very difficult trial, but one that if could be accomplished would be wonderful for all of us practicing this field. A good first step at a near comprehensive guideline, and hopefully can help provide a bit of framework for future areas of research and clinical strategy. Thanks for listening.